I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show.
Hey, this is Howard Jacobson, and I am really delighted and excited to be talking with today's guest, Dr. Milton Mills, who is Associate Director of Preventive Medicine for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, and also a critical care physician in the Washington, D.C. area. Welcome, Dr. Mills.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Yeah, I've been excited about this call since I watched a video of a talk you gave, I don't know, some weeks or months ago, and we'll get into the topic of that. But first, I'd love to begin by just getting a sense of your story and your journey to a plant-based diet. Did you grow up eating that way, or did something happen along the way?
Sure. No, actually, I did not grow up eating a plant. I mean, as a vegetarian or vegan, you know, my parents are from the South, and so while they, you know, my mother always cooked nutritious meals. I mean, they were very traditional meals that were always centered around, or usually centered around, you know, some form of animal flesh, and you know, be it chicken, beef, or pork, or whatever. But when I was a teenager, I began studying with the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and because I was looking for, a source of truth, and I started reading the Bible and then looking to see what denomination I felt was most closely adhering to what the Bible actually encouraged us to do, and that turned out to be the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And for those of your listeners who aren't aware of it, the Seventh-day Adventist Church encourages its members to become vegetarian. It's not a requirement, but they do encourage it as being a more natural and healthful diet for human beings. And after, I would say for a little over a year after I became, joined the church, I didn't embrace a plant-based diet because I just didn't think I could live without eating meat. But, as I progressed in my sort of spiritual experience and relationship with God, it got to the point where I was having some struggles, and I was dialoguing with God about it one evening, and he said to me very clearly, if you want a closer relationship with me, you need a clearer mind, and for that, you need to have a better diet. You have to give up eating meat. And so that really was the impetus for me to change my diet. It was, you know, not just the health aspects, but it was also the spiritual aspects, knowing that with a better diet and a clearer mind, I would have closer communication with God.
So how did you go about eliminating meat? Was it just after that conversation you just stopped? You know, how did that happen?
Essentially, yes. I was 16 at the time, and you know, I had a close group of friends who we were all in the church and studying together. And it's interesting because I was living with my father. My parents had divorced, and I was living with my father at the time. And I think he thought I was kind of going through a phase that I would eventually get out, you know, sort of, I guess, grow tired of. And his statement to me when I told him I was going to be vegetarian was, well, if you're going to eat differently, I'm not cooking anything different, so you're on your own. For quite a while, I sort of subsisted on peanut butter, honey, and whole wheat sandwiches. eventually I learned more about cooking and about making sure that, you know, I was getting balanced nutrition, and certainly out of that grew my interest in medicine and health and nutrition, and so it all kind of worked together to sort of get me to where I am today.
So did you find, even with peanut butter and honey and whole wheat, that you had more clarity than your previous diet?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, after, and you know, in addition, I mean, I was eating, like, you know, when my dad would fix meals, I mean, I would eat the plant portion of the meal, you know, be it beans and rice, or, you know, the vegetables, the corn, the salad, and all that. I just wouldn't touch, you know, the animal flesh portion of it. But I immediately noticed several things. One, I had a lot more energy. Two, I did have a clearer mind and sort of I felt a more agile mind. I required less sleep. Again, being a teenager, almost overnight my acne cleared up. I no longer had a problem, you know, I mean, outside of the occasional, you know, bumped out of a rise here and there, but as far as just sort of the chronic problems with acne, that all went away. And I immediately felt a difference in just the way not only my mind worked, but how my body felt and functioned.
Mm. So you got into this way of eating through the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and there's a lot of people who have found their way into plant-based diets, but they feel like they're sort of on their own. They don't have a community. And, you know, I've told people, like, it's very, the standard American diet is very unnatural, but
it absolutely is.
But eating in a way that's different from all your peers is equally unnatural. So it seems like you were able to find a way to get a good diet and a community, a sort of a normal group of people around, so that what you were doing was normal within your community.
Certainly. And I guess one of the other things that Christianity taught me is that, when you choose to do what's right, it is frequently going to put you into the minority. But that is not something that one should allow oneself to feel intimidated by, because, we are frequently put, in various places, you know, over the course of our lives, to be a signpost and an example to others. And so, you know, the fact that, you know, for instance, when I started working, I was usually the only vegetarian there, or, you know, in school and in college and so forth, that didn't bother me, because I realized that I was there for a reason, to help people bring knowledge to people that they didn't have, and to help them understand that there were alternatives to, you know, the way people usually ate, and consequently the kinds of health issues people would have as a consequence of what they were eating, and to help people understand that, you know, you didn't have to constantly feel tired and run down and sick, and you didn't have to spend your life waiting on your heart to seize up and stop working. that if you change your diet and your lifestyle, you could, you know, significantly reduce the risk of these things happening.
Mm-hmm. So, and I think that that's the easiest way that from people that I've seen who have successfully transitioned to a plant-based diet or a wholly vegan diet, is that either they are part of some community, they find a community where they feel mm-hmm. supported and normal as they do it, or they feel like a lot of ethical vegans feel, I think, the same way you do, that they're somehow a witness for something they believe in, and that their being apart from culture actually is why they're there.
Right. And I have to say, things have changed, I mean, just incredibly, since I made my diet change as a teenager. I mean, that was over 30 years ago. And back then, when you said that you're a vegetarian to someone, they looked at you like you were some sort of deviant. And if you actually said the word vegan, people would think you were speaking a foreign language. And there weren't all of the various, you know, options that are available now, either in the supermarket and certainly not in restaurants and so on. And all of that has changed, you know, in an amazing way. I mean, everybody now knows what veganism is and what vegetarians are. And, you know, you find options in almost any restaurant you step into. And, of course, the grocery store is filled with a variety of different food options for people. So, with the Internet, even if you can't find someone in your immediate vicinity who shares your dietary practices, there are online communities that you can become part of to sort of get that support and social networking that you may not have in your immediate environs.
Right. So, you know, I don't know that much about Seventh-day Adventists. I've been learning more through the concept of the Blue Zones, and I guess mm-hmm. the Seventh-day Adventist community in Loma Linda, California, is one of the healthiest, longest-living communities in the entire world. It makes me wonder, you know, if I were just going to start a church, like if I wanted to people to eat better, I think I would just start a church. It seems so much easier than trying to just get them on sort of rational grounds.
Right. Well, you know, it's kind of very straightforward and almost axiomatic in that, I mean, if any of us goes out and say buys a car or some other major appliance, we expect it to come with an owner's manual telling us how to take care of it, what fuel to put into it, you know, and so forth. And, I mean, for people who believe in God's existence and you know, who are fortunate and blessed to have a relationship with Him, I mean, you know that the Bible is His guidebook for us. And it says right up front in the very beginning, Genesis 1:29, when he put Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, he told them what to eat, and he told them to be vegans, actually. It wasn't even vegetarians. They were eating a primarily fruit-based diet, and as you read through Genesis and kind of sin entered the picture and they were forced to leave the garden, their diet was enlarged to include plant foods referred to as the plants of the field, which one can infer to include your grains, legumes, vegetables, and so on. And those are foods that had formerly been reserved only for the animals. Well, now that humans were to eat those too, to have that more varied and broad-based and balanced diet.
And so for someone who may not be a literal Bible reader, would you say that mirrors kind of what we know about the evolution of the human diet over time?
Well, It absolutely, well, it certainly corresponds with what science tells us is, without question, the best diet for human beings, and that's a plant-based diet. As you alluded to with some of the Adventists, they are, you know, some of the longest-lived people on the planet, and in all of the studies that have looked at longevity and diet around the world, those populations that consume either an entirely or predominantly plant-based diet are the populations that not only live the longest, but have the lowest risk for chronic diseases. And in terms of evolutionary theory, when you look at the fossils and creatures that are believed by many anthropologists to have given rise to the human species, what's clear from looking at their body habitus, their dentition, and their jaw structure is that they were eating a plant-based diet because they were completely ill-equipped to either hunt, kill, or dismember and consume animal foods. And then more importantly, when you look at, if you're going to follow the idea that, you know, there were a variety of different organisms that gave rise to modern human beings, then you can sort of work backwards to try and infer what the diet of the sort of pre- and proto-human humans and hominids were. And when you look at the fact that modern humans, again, have an anatomy and physiology that is completely that's consistent with consuming an entirely plant-based diet, and we have the physiologic characteristics that are typical for mammals that consume an entirely plant-based diet, that tells you that anything that gave rise to us had to also have consumed a plant-based diet, because it makes no sense that some creature that was eating a predominantly flesh food diet would suddenly give rise to a species that was adapted to eat entirely plant foods. If you understand my reasoning, that just doesn't follow. I've done a lot of work in looking and research into looking at comparative anatomy between mammalian carnivores and mammalian herbivores and humans to show that human beings have the anatomy and physiology of a committed herbivore, that we don't have the characteristics that are found in either the carnivores or the true omnivores like bears and raccoons and so forth. They have very different physiology, very different anatomy from ours.
Could you kind of give us the cliff notes on that? Because my paleo friends all tell me, look, we have, you know, carnivorous eyes, binocular eyes.
Nonsense.
And we have teeth for ripping. Help us understand those arguments in context.
Fine. Let's talk about eyes, for instance. It is true that human beings have forward set eyes, which gives us binocular vision, which is very useful for depth perception. And when you look at your typical mammalian carnivore, they also have binocular vision for good depth perception. But that's pretty much where the similarities between our eyes and carnivore eyes end. And to say that simply because we have binocular vision, that means that we are meant to be predators, is like saying that because a hummingbird has wings, it's meant to be a raptor like an eagle. Yes, a hummingbird has wings, but it uses it for very different things. And yes, we have binocular vision, but we use it for very different purposes than your typical carnivore. When you actually look inside the eye of human beings, you see their eyes are completely different from those of carnivores. Carnivores' eyes are made up primarily of what are called rod photoreceptors. And what's notable about rod photoreceptors is that they're designed for night vision. And that makes sense because carnivores are trying to hunt at night when their prey species is sleeping, because that means that they will expend less energy capturing and killing their food than if they ran around trying to chase them down during the day. Furthermore, all carnivores have a reflective layer at the back of their eye called the tapetum, which is a mirror-like surface that helps amplify low light levels. And again, that's so that they will be able to see well in the dark and hunt. They typically see 6 times better than we do. They have like permanent night vision goggles. But what's really interesting is that in the human eye, our most acute vision is located in an area of the eye called the fovea, which is actually a dimple or pit at the back of the eye that has a very high concentration of what are called cone photoreceptors. And it's the cone photoreceptors that give you very precise vision, but also that allow you to see in color. Carnivores don't have color vision. They don't have a fovea. Instead of a fovea, they have an area in the back of their retina called a linear streak, which is literally a line of cells across the back of the retina that whenever anything moves across that linear streak, they are hardwired to chase it. And that's what allows them to essentially become very good pursuit predators. And when they see something moving, they chase it and try to pounce on it and kill it because, of course, if something is moving in nature, it's probably alive and it can probably be eaten. But again, very different eyes from ours. They don't see in color. They don't have very good precision vision. They don't have a fovea. And their eyes are more adapted for seeing at night. So yes, we have binocular vision, but we have very different types of vision. And of course, the purpose of having color vision is so that you can tell when plant foods are ripe enough to eat. Because many edible plant parts, such as fruits and seed pods and so forth, in their unripened state, are loaded with toxins and other compounds to keep animals from eating them before they're ripened, because what the plant really is trying to get you to do is spread its seeds. So it doesn't want the fruit or the seed pod to be eaten before the seed has matured, because that would, in effect, work at cross purposes with what it's trying to achieve. It wants you to wait until the seed is fully mature so that when you eat the fruit, swallow the seed, you will actually carry it some distance from the parent plant and then deposit it with its own little dollop of fertilizer.
They're pretty smart, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And then when it comes to teeth, carnivore jaws actually function and operate like a pair of shears, meaning that their molars are not flattened and nodular like the plant eater's molars. They're actually shaped like blades, serrated knife blades. And the molars in the upper jaw slide completely past the molars in the lower jaw in a vertical plane. And that gives you a nice slicing motion, which, of course, is important if you're going to be dismembering prey, slicing meat off bones, and cracking bones in two. Whereas for herbivores, the jaws don't slide past each other in a horizontal plane. They actually slide across each other in a horizontal plane to give you the motion of grinding. And that's because plant foods have a lot of fiber in them and have to be, the tissues of the plants have to be disrupted and torn apart so that the digestive enzymes can actually get at the extractable nutrients that are contained in the plant tissues. So as a result, all herbivores chew their food very thoroughly to mix it up with digestive enzymes and have the process of digestion begin actually in the mouth. Carnivores don't chew their food. They slice off a chunk of meat, swallow it whole, and then the digestion occurs in the stomach and small intestine. And in fact, if you look at the ear, nose, and throat literature, you will find that 90% of the people who choke to death every year choke to death eating, trying to eat meat. And it's because we don't have the teeth and the or the esophagus to either process or swallow the stuff very efficiently. And that's why we have to use things like knives and forks and all these other utensils to try and cut up and shred these animal tissues so that we can essentially ingest them without killing ourselves.
And so I assume the anatomical differences also continue in the digestive system?
Certainly.
There's differences?
Yeah, absolutely. Carnivores have, hunting in nature is a very inefficient process. Most carnivores will only make a kill every 7 to 10 days. Studies show that 90 to 95% of their hunting efforts are unsuccessful. And so the question naturally arises, how on earth can an animal that fails to get a meal 90% of the time it makes an attempt possibly survive? Well, the way that they are able to survive is the fact that they have gigantic stomachs in comparison to your typical plant eater. The a typical carnivore has a stomach that will hold up to 30% of its body weight in food. And so what that means is that a 50-kilogram wolf can eat up to 15 kilograms of meat in one sitting. 300-pound lioness can eat 90 to 100 pounds of meat in one sitting. But let's just look at the wolf because, you know, human beings are average adult is some who is a normal weight and not overweight will be somewhere between 60 to 70 kilograms. Well, that would mean that you would have to be able to eat 18 kilograms of food at one meal, which is absolutely impossible. And a kilogram weighs 2.2 pounds, so you're talking about 35 to 40 pounds of food at one sitting. That's impossible. Now, but for a carnivore, it's absolutely necessary because they have to be able to ingest enough calories at a single meal to recover all of the energy they expended in the unsuccessful hunts, as well as the one successful hunt, as well as ingest enough calories to last them until they're able to get enough another meal. And because they are actually able to eat rotting flesh, and that's why they will frequently cover up a carcass with dirt and leaves and guard it for several days, they can extract additional energy from that carcass because they are not at all bothered by eating rotting, maggot-laden, bacteria-laden tissue. They have the stomach acid and the immune system to handle all of that, those toxic bacteria and protozoa and so forth. Whereas human beings, we don't. People get sick from eating poorly cooked turkey, and there's no way we can eat rotting tissue without killing ourselves. Furthermore, like all herbivores, we are batch feeders, meaning that we have a stomach that is relatively small, is designed for ingesting a meal, processing that meal, and then you have to go back and eat another meal in order to get enough calories to last you one day. You cannot possibly eat enough to last you 10 days. So all herbivores actually eat two or more meals every single day in order to get enough calories to live on. Whereas carnivores, because they have these giant stomachs, can eat once every 7 to 10 days, and they'll be fine. And then they have a liver which can process that sort of huge, giant calorie load without developing what's called steatohepatitis or fatty liver disease, which when human beings ingest too many calories or very rich diets, we easily develop fatty liver, and that leads to all sorts of problems, can lead to cirrhosis, can raise your risk for developing liver cancer and gallstones and a number of other problems. Moving along the digestive tract, the small intestine in carnivores is very short, typically about 4 to 6 times the body length, whereas in herbivores, it's 10 to 12 times the body length. And your average small intestine in a human being is about 30 feet long. And people sometimes say, oh, well, wait a minute, that's not 10 times the body length, because they're thinking of, you know, measuring body length as head to foot. That's not how you measure body length. You measure body length from head to tailbone. And the average torso size in a human being is 2.5 to 3 feet. So, again, we have the classic proportions of your typical herbivore. And then when you look at the large intestine in humans is fairly long. It has a pouched or sacculated structure, which is, again, typical of herbivores. And we have an appendix. You only find the appendix in plant-eating mammals. Carnivores do not have an appendix. So, and these are just some highlights of the differences. I mean, I could literally lecture for hours on the details of the differences between carnivores and herbivores. But what's crystal clear is that human beings have the anatomy and physiology of a plant eater. We are not designed to eat flesh foods, and when we do, it leads to disease. And that's why it's associated with heart disease, higher rates of cancer, higher rates of diabetes, and also linked to several autoimmune type diseases.
So you see meat eating, the evolution of meat eating in humans as kind of an emergency fuel?
Exactly. I think that human beings, and actually what's very interesting is that both sort of kind of evolutionary theory and the Bible agree that human beings originated in equatorial sort of Africa / Middle East, where you have abundant plant foods year-round. But as humans migrated into more northern latitudes or even southern latitudes that were further away from the equator, you got into temperate regions where plant foods weren't available year-round. And that is when you start to see human beings developing the technologies to hunt animals so that they could use them for the calories that weren't available from the plant foods during the winter months. It was more of a bridge to help us, you know, through the times when our principal foods weren't available. But, you know, as always, when you're dealing with human cultures, you evolve a culture to support a practice, and then the culture takes on a life of its own. And the best analogy I can come up with is that, you know, I ask people, why is it that, you know, women will go out and spend, you know, thousands, sometimes even tens of thousands of dollars on a big white wedding dress that serves absolutely no practical purpose? It doesn't restore her hymen, doesn't make anybody forget how many boyfriends that we've all seen. That she's had, but it's become a cultural imperative, and that's why we do it. You know, it's the same reason 40-year-old guys go out and buy some, you know, little red sports car, because they think it's going to somehow make them more appealing and more attractive, although it has absolutely no practical survival advantages.
Right, it's just a social signal.
Exactly.
Well, this is really fascinating, and I didn't realize we were going to get into this. I have so many more questions about this, but I think we're giving people enough of an overview. But I will state that, you know, in the book that I helped Dr. Campbell write, Whole, we have a chapter on reductionist versus holistic research.
Mm-hmm.
And try to, because there's lots of reductionist research that's out there that seems to point to animal products being good for humans. But when we look at the, you know, one of the sources of holistic research, what we listed was evolutionary biology, in which we say, you know, we share almost all the characteristics of herbivores and have almost nothing in common with carnivores. When I was writing that bit, I wish I'd known you, because I could have put in a lot more detail. But to me, that just, it seems like a common sense observation, a common sense set
right.
of observations. Like, if this is true, then we can't be obligate meat eaters.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's, I mean, what research tells us is that no matter how much fat and cholesterol you feed to dogs and cats and other carnivores, they never ever develop coronary artery disease. They never develop blockages in their arteries, because they have a lipoprotein metabolism that allows them to essentially dispose of all of this fat and cholesterol that they absorb from their gut. But when you turn around and feed diets that are high in fat and cholesterol to classic herbivores like rabbits, rodents, and humans and other primates, we very easily and relatively quickly begin to develop hardening of the arteries, because we are not designed to eat that type of a diet.
Don't say that too loud, or else some drug company is going to start harvesting, you know, tiger enzymes into pills, so we can eat meat without hardening of the arteries.
Well, you know, the tragedy is that, you know, that one of the reasons that bears are often killed is because their gallbladders are used in traditional Chinese medicine and other folk medicines to treat gallstones. And the reason it will treat gallstones is that the majority of gallstones that human beings get are made up of cholesterol that has precipitated out of our bile and formed stones. And bear bile is so strong that if it's ingested by humans, it's concentrated into our gallbladder, where it can actually dissolve the gallstones, because that's what they're designed to do, is to eat that kind of a diet. But we don't have to kill bears to do that, because we now have drugs which will do the same thing. So it's not that it was ever necessary, but it certainly isn't, you know, in this day and age. But rather than destroying the earth to try and support an abnormal lifestyle such as meat eating and so forth, it makes much more sense to instead switch to the diet that we are designed to eat in the first place, that promotes the best health, the greatest longevity, and leave the other stuff alone. You know, I you know, one thing that I say in just about all my lectures is I tell people that nobody ever asks for a fried chicken or a pork chop in the delivery room. When we are born as babies, we are born without preferences. Everything that we think we like, we had to learn to like. And just as we have learned to like things that are unhealthy and that harm our health, we can unlearn those bad habits and learn to like the foods that are actually good for us instead.
Right. And then in my experience, that's absolutely true. So I don't want to let you go without getting to the topic that fascinated me so much when I saw your video. So you are African American.
Yes.
You know, and you have written about the you know, sort of racist elements of the food
dietary guidelines.
Guidelines, but you
right.
So you, the talk you gave, so you're very interested in sort of this intersection of food, nutrition, and race and class. You talked about the what's come to be thought of as a traditional African American diet, especially in the American South,
right,
as actually being a slave diet.
Correct.
Which blew my mind. Can you go into that a little bit?
Sure. I'd be very happy to. It all revolves around this topic of what I call so-called soul food. And what people refer to as soul food classically includes dishes like chitlins and oxtails and pig's feet and pig ears and all of these very, very unhealthy types of flesh foods that we know promote excess disease within communities of color, particularly within the African American community. And unfortunately, many African Americans embrace this because they feel like, oh, this is our cultural heritage, this is soul food, when in fact it's not our cultural heritage. And what I try to help people understand is that when you look at traditional West African diets, traditional West African diets, and the reason I keep emphasizing traditional is because, of course, unfortunately, many of these large fast food concerns have, you know, they're exporting their lifestyle, their restaurants around the world, and you know, a lot of the large urban areas and so the major African cities, you can find McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken and all that stuff over there now as well. But when you look at traditional West African diets that haven't been corrupted by Western habits, those diets are diets that are largely plant-based diets, low in fat. They are based around greens, legumes, and root vegetables. They contain no dairy foods and very little meat. And that is what our true heritage is. It is and the reason I focus on West Africa is that because that's where the American slaves were taken from. They were taken from the western coast of Africa and the peoples that lived there. And so, again, we come from populations that traditionally ate a very low-fat, plant-based diet. But when the slaves were brought over to the American plantations, they were literally forced to eat the garbage of the plantations. So the things that the slave owners didn't want to eat, such as the entrails, which became chitlins, or the tails of the pigs, or the cattle, which became oxtails, or their ears, or their feet, all of that stuff that they used to throw away, they gave to the slaves and said, here, you eat this. This is what's going to be your food. And, you know, of course the slaves did the best that they could with trying to take this garbage and turn it into something edible. But the tragedy is that once slavery ended, instead of us as African Americans rejecting what is truly an echo and vestige of plantation life, we turned around and owned it and called it soul food. It's not soul food. It is plantation food. And it's very unhealthy, and it causes excess rate of disease in our community, and it's killing us at very early ages, and we need to get away from it.
So I recently read that, Sandera Nation, the African-American woman who was featured in the documentary Forks Over Knives, who, you know, lost 100 pounds on a plant-based diet and reversed her diabetes, that she got a lot of grief from her friends and family for eating what they called white people's food. So when you bring this message to African-American communities, to church groups, what response do you get? Do you get pushback, or do people's eyes open?
I think because I start off with you talking about what our true heritage is, and that is looking back to West Africa and looking at what traditional West African diets are, people are able to understand a lot more clearly that This has nothing to do with being white people's food. I mean, it may be that here in, you know, in the United States, because, you know, Caucasian Americans tend to be more affluent and have better access to grocery stores and, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables, that they tend to eat better in this country. But that's an artifact of the economic and social situations that we find ourselves in. It has nothing to do with, you know, it being something that is particularly germane to, you know, to only white Americans. And so, again, that's why I try to point people back to traditional West African diets to make them understand that this is where our gene pool comes from. This is the diet that we adapted to. These are the diets that promote the best health within our community. And then to also help them understand that, you know, Africans, traditional West Africans, don't eat this crap that we call soul food. And that this is a direct link to plantation life. Because that's where we learn to eat this stuff. Not in Africa, but on the plantation. And in fact, the last vestiges of slavery we are carrying around with us on our dinner plates.
Yeah, my thought was that, you know, for your audiences to hear this would feel like liberation, like a final cutting of the cord.
I mean, for people who are ready to hear it, it certainly can be very liberating. But the one thing that I've come to understand about, you know, us as humans is that food for us is far more than simple nutrition. There are, you know, aspects of cultural identity, of family and so forth that are bound up with not only what we eat but the ways that we eat. And that frequently when you talk to people about the need to change their diet, that they will have an emotional and not rational response to what you're suggesting, because in talking about the, you know, leaving the ways in which they are used to eating and preparing their food, you're essentially telling them that you've got to, in some respects, sever your ties to grandmom, to your mother, to, you know, your traditional family holiday celebrations and so forth. So, you know, people have to understand that you can make these changes and still be true to yourself, you know, from, you know, an ethnic standpoint, because you can, in essence, veganize, you know, many traditional foods that are served, you know, as cultural icons and cultural dishes, so that you can preserve that cultural identity, but you preserve it in a way that promotes health as opposed to destroying it.
Right. I know when I moved down to North Carolina from New Jersey, I had never seen collard greens in the supermarket. Like, they were kind of a specialty item, and here, giant bags of collards.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, that's a sort of a traditional African American food that was far superior to anything I was eating.
I was gonna say, yeah, and let me hasten to say that is one of the traditional parts of what is traditionally considered soul food that is actually extremely healthy. So you can eat all the collard greens you want. You just don't have to put ham hocks and bacon fat in them to give them flavor. There are other ways to do that so that they are much healthier for you. But the greens themselves are actually very healthy foods and should be eaten as often as possible by everyone.
Right. So before we go, how are the dietary guidelines of the United States racist?
Well, they... And actually, a couple different ways. And I think one of the things that it's important for people to understand is that when I first started working with PCRM, one of the first projects I worked on with them was looking at trying to get changes in the U.S. dietary guidelines. And I came to that project with the mistaken notion that the U.S. dietary guidelines were put out by the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS. And that, in fact, is not the case. The U.S. dietary guidelines are put out by the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture. And the USDA has as its primary charge that its job is to increase the market for U.S. agricultural output. And so, as a result, the dietary guidelines have always been very heavily weighted towards encouraging the consumption of dairy foods and other animal-based foods, because that is what many of the U.S., largest U.S., agribusinesses and farmers are actually producing, even though the USDA has known for years that the science does not support the consumption of these foods because, in fact, they do increase a number of different chronic diseases. Well, let's just look at dairy foods, for instance. The fact is that the vast majority of Americans of color are lactose intolerant. It turns out that 73% of African Americans, 70% of Native Americans, 95% of Asian Americans, and 53% of Hispanic Americans are lactose intolerant, meaning that if they ingest lactose-containing foods, they will end up with gas, bloating, diarrhea, and other forms of gastrointestinal distress because they can't digest and absorb the lactose that's in the milk. And you contrast that with the fact that, on average, only about 30 to 33% of Caucasian Americans have a problem ingesting lactose. Well, so then why are people being encouraged to consume dairy foods? Well, then people say, well, you have to get your calcium. That's utter nonsense. You don't need dairy foods to get calcium. Calcium is distributed through a number of plant foods. I often point out to people, cows don't drink milk or eat dairy foods, yet there's plenty of calcium in their milk. Why? Because they get it from green leafy vegetables, which is the same place that we can get it from. And we can get it in a much healthier form. It doesn't come with all this fat and excess protein that creates disease. So the fact is that people are encouraged to eat dairy foods not because for health reasons, because dairy has never been shown to be protective against osteoporosis. In fact, the opposite has been shown, that the countries around the world, and even within the United States, both the countries around the world and the populations within this country that consume the most dairy foods actually have the highest rates and risk for osteoporosis. Furthermore, high consumption of dairy foods has been linked to increased risk for prostate cancer and certain forms of ovarian cancer. And prostate cancer is a major problem within the African American community, because it turns out that it's more than twice as prevalent amongst African American men, and once we develop it, we are 2 to 3 times as likely to die from it as Caucasian American men, because we tend to get more aggressive and deadly forms of the disease. So it really is a gross disservice to African American community and other communities of color for the government to encourage them to eat foods that they don't need for their health. And then when you look at the other aspects of the dietary guidelines, again, that tend to be heavily weighted towards consuming animal flesh foods and lots of fat. Again, the government knows for a fact, because the science has been there for over 30 years, that this type of a diet will promote excess levels of chronic disease in all populations, but particularly in communities of color, yet they still recommend these foods. Not because it's healthier for us, but simply because they are trying to provide a market for U.S. agribusiness, and that is absolutely racist.
That is outrageous.
It is. It absolutely is.
Wow. So there is so much more that I would love to ask you, and I know we're almost at an hour, but on behalf of our listeners, if people want to find out more, if they want to hear more from you, find your speeches, your videos, your writings, where can they go?
Certainly they can Google my name, Dr. Milton Mills, and there's a number of different articles that will come up, or and they can go to YouTube, and there are several of my lectures that have been posted to YouTube that will immediately come up that they can watch on a number of different topics. And they can also contact PCRM at pcrm.org for additional information as well.
Great. So I'll post links to PCRM and to some of the YouTube lectures.
Okay, wonderful.
Dr. Mills, thank you so much. This has been just a treat for me to hear your perspective, your erudition, the incredible amount of research you've done on this, and the passion and clarity with which you present this message. I don't know any thinking person who could listen to this and not be convinced.
Well, thank you very much. Very kind. Very, very kind words. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, be well. I look forward to talking with you again.
Okay. I'll be happy to come back at some point. Thank you for having me.
A pleasure. Take care.
All right.
Let's take this home with some gratitudes. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize. All the stuff that I do is for you, so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.